the path the Buddha offered, and all the teachings. Point in the direction of freedom from suffering. The different descriptions of the journey, a few we've been looking at in these weeks. The cultivation of qualities that support the mind to let go. Let go of craving. The possibility that the teachings point to is this freedom. The word, one of the words used for this freedom is nirvana. That's the Pali version. Nirvana is the Sanskrit version. And often it's translated as enlightenment. People think of it as, well, it seems in Western cultures at least, enlightenment is the phrase that people seem to feel Buddhism is going for, you know, enlightenment. Awakening, another word sometimes used. Another word that's in this area is the word that's used in the teaching on transcendent dependent origination, release, vimutti. And nibbana has a similar quality in the word itself. The words that we use to translate it, enlightenment in particular, that sounds like the acquisition of something, the gaining of something. But the Pali words vimutti and nibbana, vimutti, release, nibbana, literally means something like cooling, the release of heat. It's kind of an analogy. I think of this word as an analogy of what happens the process of something coming to a state of equilibrium. Often goes from higher energy to lower energy. Release of heat. Now the cooling. If you cook some food, the food we put out on the table, you know, it cools off. It's just the natural process, the cooling. The food nibbanas releases its heat. And the Buddha used the analogy of heat for what's happening for us in our usual way of dealing with the world. In one of his famous, I think it's the third discourse, maybe second, called the Fire Sermon. He said, everything is burning. The eye is burning, the ear is burning. What is it burning with? The fires of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so the analogy, too, of the painful reactive states of mind as heat is burning, and actually kind of feels that way when we touch into the experience of them. Contraction, burning tension, not released. So in the suttas, the descriptions of Nibbana or how it's talked about is primarily what it's not. It's not clinging, not craving, the absence of greed, aversion, delusion. It's not something we get. The mind, at one point in the text, the moments before awakening are described as the non-fashioning mind letting go of fashioning. So many absences in these descriptions. Here's some of the words. The extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion. This indeed is called Nibbana. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed, with mind ensnared, one aims at one's own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and experiences mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, one aims neither at one's own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and experiences no mental pain and grief. This is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. And for one thus freed, in whose heart dwells peace, for one thus freed from greed, aversion, delusion, in whose heart dwells peace, there is nothing to be added to what has been done, and nothing remains to be done. Just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so neither forms, nor sounds, nor odors, nor tastes, nor contacts of any kind, neither the desired nor the undesired, can cause such a one to waver. Steadfast is the mind. Gained is deliverance. Those, a few things about those. A couple of pieces that are kind of just like highlight to me. One is the result of the ending of greed, aversion, delusion is the state of no mental pain and grief. Again, an absence. Experiences no mental pain and grief. That sounds pretty good to me. And then another piece in here is the phrase, this is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life. The possibility of this absence of greed, absence of aversion, absence of delusion as something that can be experienced here and now, or the absence of that. It's experienced here and now, the absence of it. But the experience without greed, aversion, and delusion, the Buddha says, is visible in this life. It's not kind of the die and go to heaven analogy. Freedom, that release, possible in this very life. So the teachings tell us, so they say. The Buddha talks a little bit about his own experience, a little bit more in the what it's like to be in the mind of freedom. Aside from no mental pain and grief, which sounds pretty good to me. That's even that, you know, it's like maybe I have a sense of what it might be, you know, to walk around this world, just a little bit of a taste, having every now and then tasted what it might be like for a little bit of greed or aversion or delusion to fall away. You know, they're just those little tastes that we get. Might get a sense of the possibility of what it could be like if greed, aversion, and delusion were never to arise again. Just a little taste of that. The Buddha describes a little bit about his own experience, and we talked about this, explored this a little bit the other day in talking about the Bahiya Sutta. We went through this description. I'll just read this just to remind you. A Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight, does not conceive of an unseen, does not conceive of a thing worth seeing, does not conceive of a seer. And likewise for hearing, sensing, and cognizing. Does not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight, does not conceive of an unseen, does not conceive of a thing worth seeing, does not conceive of a seer. This absence of, again, the absence of a conception of one who sees, of something seen. It's a little, it's hard to understand this description. We unpacked it a little bit the other day. But there's another bit of the description here. He says of his own experience, whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained and sought after and pondered over by the mind, that I have fully understood. All that is fully known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken a stand on it. So again, a kind of an absence of, not taking a stand. This to me kind of evokes a little bit of the reflections we've been exploring around impermanence and, you know, nowhere to land, nothing actually to like hold on to. We try to hold on, but things are just slipping so fast. We suffer when we try to hold on. So the not taking a stand here is described as this not conceiving, not clinging, not craving, not attaching to views about, not creating an idea of there being somewhere to stand. The Buddha's word for this state or understanding, he said it was, all this has been fully understood, all has been fully known, but the Tathagata has not taken a stand on it. We normally take stands on things. Something's known, yep, I know that. This is how it is. This is what I need to do. We take stands all the time. In subtle, very subtle ways. I mean, we obviously take stands in big ways too, you know. I'm this kind of person. I believe these kinds of things. But in very subtle ways too, we take a stand on what it means to be aware. So the Buddhist word for this is tadi, in Pali, and it's translated sometimes as such. That word is, again, it can kind of evoke a quality, maybe. I think that the translators are trying to help us get some of the flavor of the word with this translation of such. Just such things, thus, such experiences, thus, not anything else other than it is. Nothing added. Not landing with it. Understanding the impermanent, conditioned nature. The mind doesn't pick things up. Doesn't hold on. This is this such. Again, the not conceiving around what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized. Just the experience as it is. The Bihiya Sutta points to this as the training. In the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only cognized. He's pointing to that possibility of such. Nothing other than what it is, impermanent, unreliable, not a thing, not even a thing. Already falling apart as soon as it arises. Continual transition. Alignment with that. Experience with that. The other aspect of this, perhaps, is the this of such there is that not only is, you know, all this experience arising and ceasing and being known, but again, it is this mind creating these arisings and ceasings. So these arisings and ceasings are nothing other than these arisings and ceasings knowing themselves. No one doing any of it, just the processes of consciousness and feeling and perception, being conscious and feeling and perceiving such, nothing else. The Buddha's description of the mind that understands that is free from craving, not going to pick anything up, because it so deeply understands the non-usefulness of that. Well, there's an interesting variation of translation for this word, tadi. And it comes about a little bit through some of the analogies that are used. There's another in that quote about, just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so neither forms nor sounds nor odors nor tastes nor contacts of any kind Neither the desired nor the undesired can cause such a one to waver. Steadfast is the mind. The word, I believe the word steadfast there, I mean, I've checked the Pali, and tadi is used in that sentence, and I think that this translator is translating tadi or such here as steadfast. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as stable. Stable is the mind. And the image of, you know, a mass of a mountain not being shaken by wind, that's a stable image. And so this word tadi is used in that context. So the one translator says the Buddha describes that his experience is being ever stable amongst things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized. Now, this feels like a little bit of a paradox in some ways, because what one is stable in, or is this radically slippery, changing set of conditions? Nothing stable in the experience, and yet the experience of stability. What does that mean? We normally associate this, the word stable, with something to lean on or stand on or something to kind of ground against. But here, the stability comes from the very alignment with nothing to ground with and not resisting that. To me, this evokes a very radically different feeling of stability. But I can imagine that quality of a mind not wavering. That's the quality, the not wavering. That's the other language in this. Neither forms, nor sounds, nor odors, nor tastes, nor contacts of any kind, neither the desired nor the undesired, can cause such a one to waver. So no wavering. Not disturbed, not excited, just stable. A stability that is, I think of it as coming with the alignment of the truth, with the truth of impermanent, unreliable, nothing to land on, nothing even existing, no thing. What we think of as things are just continually mutating and changing. No thing there. Some of these descriptions may sound inspiring, and some may sound confusing, and some may sound like, why would I want that? But I think the key pointing in freedom is freedom from suffering. The framing that the Buddha offers in the Four Noble Truths, you know, there is suffering. Suffering arises with the arising of craving, and the ending of craving is the ending of suffering. This is a kind of a more potentially accessible and inspiring, you know, yeah, I'll go for that. I'll go for no more suffering, but this notion of like everything completely changing. I don't know about that one. You know, I don't know that I want to align with that truth. And yet the practice that we do to explore what it means to let go of craving slowly begins to help us to see that aligning with the truth of impermanence creates way more peace and ease in the mind. So we begin to taste that. We begin to have some of those tastes. So there was a question I said yesterday, someone submitted a question about enlightenment, and I'll read it in a couple different pieces because there's some different pieces to respond to in the question. There seem to be many stories of people attaining enlightenment, and they're certainly true in the suttas. There's a lot of places where somebody has a conversation with the Buddha, and then it either says, you know, that person hearing those words became enlightened, or one of my favorite ones, that person teaching that talk became enlightened while giving the talk. May it be so. Or they often will say, more often, it's something like the person, you know, kind of got the teaching from the Buddha, bowed to him, and went off and practiced. And in some period of time or other, became enlightened. So there's a lot of those stories in the suttas. And so there seem to be many stories of this in the suttas, and yet I don't know of anyone in current times who's enlightened. How would we know? And they add, if someone said they were enlightened, I would likely be skeptical. This is a piece of it, you know, it's like the proclaiming enlightenment is a good sign that somebody's probably not enlightened. And in fact, there are the monastics have some rules they live by, and one of them is to not to talk about their attainments, at least with lay people. I mean, there are suttas where people talk about their attainments with the Buddha, but in general, it's not a topic of conversation. How would we know? I don't think we do. Although, you know, there are some ways we get a flavor. I mean, whether somebody's fully enlightened or not, I don't know that we can know that. But we can get a sense of someone who behaves really ethically, kindly, who doesn't seem to have a lot of greed, aversion, or delusion, not a lot of reactivity. We feel that. So full enlightenment, I don't know, but you know, I've met some people in the Sagaing Hills in Burma that I don't know if they're fully awakened, but they're very free. Very free. There's a sense, you know, sitting in their presence of just a different mind that's sitting in front of you. It's something so different. Sayadaw Utejaniya's teacher, Shwe Umin Sayadaw, there were rumors that he was fully enlightened, although he would not say that. I understand. I did not get to meet him, but one of my friends did. And he said it was a very impactful experience just to sit in front of him. Just, you know, I don't know what it is. how that happens or what it is. But so I think there's some way that we resonate with freedom. Even a little bit of freedom, I think we resonate with. Somebody who seems to understand something or behave in a different way or just... So I think these are pointers for us. These are pointers for us. There is a teaching in the suttas. I tried to find it. I was unsuccessful. I'm pretty sure it's in the Majjhima, but, I had about 30 minutes. Couldn't find it. So I'm just going to try to paraphrase it roughly from what I remember. And it's something about the Buddha talking about how do you find a good teacher? And he says something like, well, you go and you hang out with them for a long time. And you see, do they engage skillfully with people? Do they demonstrate greed or aversion? If they do, maybe not such a good teacher. So it was this kind of the thing that impressed me about this, how do you find a good teacher? It's like, go and hang out with them for a while and see how they are. Get to know them. See how they relate to people, how they act in the world. He didn't give them a question to ask, like, are you enlightened or not? But I think, again, we have a feeling of the direction of freedom. I think our heart kind of resonates with goodness. So more of this question. Sometimes enlightenment seems like a story for inspiration. I think, that seems useful. That whether or not we know it's possible for ourselves, and we can't know it's possible for ourselves until it happens. But the possibility can be an inspiration. And I think too, those like steps in that direction, or the flavor of someone who maybe is a few steps ahead of us on the path, the kind of quality that they evoke in us, it is an inspiration. So there's that again, I think it's the pull towards goodness, the pull towards wisdom, the pull towards non-craving. The pull towards ease and peace. It's the natural direction. The pull here I'm talking about is kind of like the pull of gravity going downhill that we were talking about with the water just naturally running downhill. I think our hearts naturally gravitate towards wisdom and goodness when we give them the chance to. And so that inspiration is useful. It kind of sparks that direction, sparks that natural movement towards goodness. So the person says, sometimes that enlightenment seems like a story for inspiration. And yet I do experience this to be a path of freedom gained in moments over a lifetime. This feels like inspiration enough. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That is my experience also. that I don't know. You know, I don't know, but I have a lot of confidence in the possibility of freedom. I don't know what that, you know, these descriptions of a fully enlightened mind, I don't know what that's like. But the little tastes, those moments of freedom, tastes of anger falling away or wanting falling away, and the release and the feeling of alignment with, yeah, don't need to pick that up. It's not useful to head that way. That leads to suffering. The mind experiences that directly. And that becomes its own gravitational pull. That becomes its own force leading onwards. Not just inspiration in stories, but inspiration from our own experience. These moments of freedom, moments of release from greed, aversion, and delusion. Maybe not complete absence of greed, aversion, and delusion in those moments, but the taste of it. A little taste, moments, pointers towards freedom. Those flavors, those tastes are very compelling in a way. You know, they really, they give us confidence. In certain ways, you know, it's like, I can't do anything but be on this path. There's nothing else that makes any sense. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu had a word for these like moments of flavors or tastes of freedom. He called them temporary nibbana. And he said this is paraphrased. Anyone can see that if states of greed, aversion, and delusion were with us all day and all night, every second without ceasing, living things must either die or become insane. Let us consider that we survive because there are periods, moments, that the fires of greed, aversion, and delusion are not burning. He points out that these moments of greed, aversion, and delusion not happening are so quiet, so subtle, so, you know, nothing that we would actually notice because we have our attention on much more obvious things, that they just slip right by us sometimes. And Joseph says, they're so subtle that we just don't see them. Joseph Goldstein, in talking about this, says, yeah, they're just so subtle, these little moments without greed, aversion, and delusion. We may miss them. We're much more attuned to the grosser phenomenon. And so as it gets quiet, you know, those places where there's not much going on, we usually get bored. But maybe that's a place to begin to taste the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. Michelle McDonald says that we need to acquire a taste for that. We don't usually appreciate that fineness, very fine flavor. The flavor of absence. We like the strong, spicy flavors, things that point themselves out to us. Gil gave an analogy at one point that made an impression on me about these little moments too, of, you know, just a little bit, those ones that we do recognize, right? Not the ones that just go slip by us because they're so subtle. But the ones that we do recognize, those tastes of seeing the falling away of aversion, or and just experiencing that, a few moments even of ease and peace and contentment. We get a little taste, it's like just a little glimpse maybe of the possibility. And there's a way that we might, from that, have the confidence that that flavor in those moments, it doesn't feel impossible for that to be the state of the mind. And Gil's analogy was very mundane. He said, you have a linoleum floor. Linoleum gets pretty dirty pretty quickly, right? And in fact, I have about a 25-year-old linoleum floor in my house, and I've spent some time trying to scrub it, and I can get little pieces of it pretty clean. And he says, if you go and you scrub that linoleum floor, you get even like one little, square of that linoleum clean. You work really hard and you get it clean. You know, at least theoretically, that it's clean, that you can get it clean, that is possible, And then you might meet somebody that says, hey, come look at my linoleum floor. I got it completely clean. And it's like, oh, wow, maybe it is possible. So that inspiration, but also that inspiration connected to something of our own understanding. I think the inspiration towards freedom becomes much more alive when we do have some of those tastes, even small tastes of the mind letting go of something. And another way to explore, another way that freedom is expressed in the suttas. This is in some of the oldest texts that are recorded. Some of the earliest, potentially some of the earliest teachings of the Buddha, maybe before he really codified, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Five Faculties, Seven Factors of Awakening, before all of that was kind of structured and codified. He was just kind of wandering around and talking to people. When he met them, he would have conversations with them. And some of these are recorded. Some of these conversations are recorded. And this one set of poems in the Sutta Nipata called the Atthakavagga. It's a fairly short text, but there's a bunch of descriptions. This is early descriptions of what it is to be a freed person. Early descriptions of how do you describe somebody who's free? And then, how do you describe somebody who's not free? There's basically three flavors of poems in this. So what is it like when somebody's free? What is it like when they're not free? And how do you get from one to the other? How do you become free? And so in one of the poems, somebody asks the Buddha, having what vision, being of what character, is one called peaceful? Tell me about the Supreme Person. So this is a questioner asking the Buddha to describe somebody who's free. And the description here is really, I would say it's really down to earth. Largely, he's describing what they do and don't do, mostly what they don't do, and a little bit about their state of mind. So the Buddha says, a person who is not angered, not frightened, not boastful, not fretful, who gives wise advice, who is calm, restrained in speech, who is indeed a sage. A person who's not attached to the future, who does not sorrow over the past, who finds solitude amidst sense contact and is not guided by fixed views. A person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not greedy, nor impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech. A person who does not relish pleasure, who is not arrogant, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous, who by nothing is repelled. A person who does not take on the training in hopes of material gain, who is unperturbed if they get nothing, who is not hampered by wishes and not greedy for flavors. A person who is even-tempered, ever attentive, who does not suppose that in the world they are equal, superior, or inferior, who is free of conceit. A person for whom there are no tethers, who, knowing truth, is not tethered in any way, and in whom no wishes are found for existence or non-existence. This is someone I call peaceful. They are indifferent to sense pleasure. In them, bonds are not found. They have overcome attachment. So this is a description of in this life, that first paragraph that, you know, described. This is Nibbana immediate, visible in this life, when greed, aversion, and delusion are given up. And this is a description of somebody walking around the world and how they are, you know, engaging with people and the calm, the mildness, the not argumentative. Again, a lot of what they're not. Not saying so much, here's how they are. To me, this is inspiring. The whole kind of framing in the negative, in a way, is inspiring. Because it's like, what happens when greed, aversion, and delusion fall away in a particular mind? There's a lot of things that wouldn't happen when greed, aversion, and delusion fall away. You wouldn't get argumentative. You wouldn't be mean to people. You wouldn't be greedy. Many things here. Wouldn't be impudent. You wouldn't be mean to people. But it doesn't say so much how you would be, but that kind of falling away of all of those things. Who might you be without greed, aversion, and delusion? There's a lot of room for different expressions of freedom. These beings that I met in the Sagaing Hills. Again, I don't know if they were fully awakened or not, but they were pretty amazing beings to be around. And two in particular I'm thinking of, really different. One of them was so quiet. So quiet. I walked into his monastery the very first time, and I felt like I walked into this sea of calm. Just walking into the monastery, it's like, whew, wow, what's this? I hadn't even met the monk yet. I later talked to Carol Wilson. She was with us. There was a group of us walking around the Sagaing Hills, and And we went and visited a number of these people. And as we left the monastery, I said, "Carol, you know, I don't feel I'm very sensitive to these things. You know, I don't usually think of myself as like being very sensitive, but this is what I experienced here." And it's like, wow, that was amazing. And she looked at me, she said, "Andrea, it's not subtle here." Like, okay, I get it. So that sense of him, and in his presence, I just wanted to sit in his presence and just like absorb his calm, his peace. I just wanted to sit there. And the translator that was with us said, "Well, he won't stay with us unless you ask him a question." So the next few times I came with a question in my pocket so I could ask him a question. Another of the monastics we met, he was just so happy. Really, really happy. It's like you couldn't keep him from laughing. The monks in Burma, I don't know if this is general, but the monks in Burma are not supposed to smile when their pictures are taken. And one of the people I was with was asking, you know, could we have a picture with the Sayadaw? And he had the hardest time not smiling. I think he had to actually cover his mouth for the picture. One of the last times I saw him, maybe not the very last, but I went to see him and he had been ill, and my memory of him was like, he's just shrunk. You know, he was in a chair and I was just like this, he was just like so little. And we were speaking through a translator, but it's so, what happened there is so vivid to me. It's like I heard him say this directly. And we asked, you know, inquired, because we'd heard he'd been sick, you know, and he just started laughing. And he said, "Oh yeah, I almost died the other day." Like, wow. You know, just these expressions of freedom, and so different, you know. I don't know I ever saw Sayadaw Ujjayanta laughing like that. Myatong Sayadaw, just really just so delighted all the time. And from that, to me, it's like, yeah, and that these beings, they have their own expression of freedom. And think of the Dalai Lama. He's got an expression of freedom, too, and how much people just gravitate towards him. And, you know, I think of kindness as being his expression of freedom. And so, you know, the freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion leaves a lot of room for something to happen, something to express itself, something beautiful to express itself in so many different ways. I think we might have an idea of like, oh, you know, what the practice is, very serious or something, and free of greed, aversion, and delusion must look like something, and maybe subconsciously we're trying to model that, trying to, I don't know, make things serious or keep things calm or quiet or something. Honor your expression of freedom. What might that be? For some, an expression of freedom may be sitting in Sayadaw Ujjayanta, the monk in the Calm Monastery. You know, he didn't leave that monastery very much. And yet the expression of freedom there, it's like, it still ripples out. It's not, It's not that some expressions of freedom are better than others. They're just different expressions of freedom, and they affect the world in different ways. Maybe the story I told of walking into that monastery and how he was will ripple out. He had a big impression on me. Will ripple out from this story. So I don't think of, you know, some expressions of freedom are very active and out there, and like Gandhi, very different expression of freedom. But I think we have to understand that each being will have their own flowering, and not to dismiss any particular flowering of freedom. I think this path of practice offers so much possibility. Possibility we can't even imagine. And can we have the courage to step into that vastness of possibility? Allow our hearts to expand to the vastness of possibility rather than trying to keep ourselves safe in our self-constructed castles of identity. It takes courage. And patience. Because we don't always have the courage. And we need to honor that when that's the case. We each have our own journey. Sometimes the journey is really feeling the castle, feeling the boundaries. And that begins to soften the walls, break them down, so that we can begin to see the possibilities.